I have one design where you can take the notebook, put it in the microwave for about a minute, and it'll all erase. And then you'll be able to reuse it over and over. And Jason just said, stop, stop. That is literally the only good thing you've ever said, right? If you don't announce that as your product, there's no way you're going to be on my stage.
Welcome to Eating Glass. It's a podcast where in each episode, we ask startup founders the questions no one else will. Our goal? To reveal what it's actually like to start, scale, and exit a company. I'm Joe LeMay, and I bootstrapped my reusable notebook company, Rocketbook, to a $50 million exit.
And I am Will Nitza, founder and CEO at IQBar, a nutrition company I took from zero to 40 plus million in annual revenue. For better or worse, we are your hosts. Eating Glass is sponsored by IQBar, which is my company, so be nice to it. What do we do here? We make IQ Bar plant protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe instant mushroom coffees, all of which are special because they are the only thing in their category that centers on nutrients good for your body, protein, electrolytes, things like that, as well as things that are good for your brain, so magnesium or lion's mane to name a few. They are all delicious. Most functional foods and drinks taste like crap. Ours taste good, and taste matters. That is despite them being super low in sugar and super clean label. There's no weird stuff on our labels. And by the way, they're affordable. Functional stuff is usually price gougy, and we are not. I will not be offering a discount code. I will instead ask you a favor. Go to Amazon.com, search for IQ Bar, IQ Mix, IQ Joe, or some combination of the three. Find a non-sponsored listing, click on it, buy it, wait for it to arrive, and leave a review. And that is the only favor I will ever ask you. Thank you very much. Eating Glass is also sponsored by Ramp. Ramp is a corporate card and spend management software that we at IQBar have used for 5 years now, I think. And I actually reached out to them about sponsoring, not the other way around. I love them for three reasons. Number one, simplicity. Everyone on our team gets a physical and a digital card. Replacing cards, pausing cards, putting limits on cards, insanely easy. Setup takes 10 minutes. Number two, cash back. 1.5% cash back. You don't have to deal with points. If you're messing around with points, you are wasting your time. Just get cash back. Number three, they are better at categorizing spend. So we not only save money on the cashback side, we save time on closing our books because they're just better at classifying. They give us an incredible offer for you guys. $250 free dollars when you sign up for Ramp today. Go to ramp.com/glass. That's ramp.com/glass. Cards are issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply. Final sponsor is Gorgias, G-O-R-G-I-A-S. This is the help desk slash customer service app we use at IQBar. We've used it for years. Similar situation, I reached out to them about sponsoring, and we actually started on Zendesk and moved to Gorgias. Our customer service had forced us to, basically, and I was like, why did you force us to do that? Why is Gorgias so much better? And he said, number one, apps and integrations are just better. We have a customer base on Shopify, Amazon. We want to be able to take phone calls. Like, all of that filters into one dashboard and it makes his life easier. His user experience is easier. There's less clicking, less typing because of all the automations inherent to the Gorgias platform. He just has to do less, click less, have less tabs open. And the final thing is, it's really good for consumer brands. So returns, refunds, things that are centric to a business like mine are made really, really easy via the Gorgias platform. Go to Gorgias.com. Again, that's G-O-R-G-I-A-S. Request a free trial. Mention us, Eating Glass. You will get preferential treatment and you'll be up and running in 15 days. Boom. Joe LeMay, welcome to your own podcast.
It's awesome to be here as a guest on this prestigious podcast.
I already know who you are, obviously, although I do feel that there's a lot of stuff we have yet to dig deep on. So I think this could be a good exercise for that. I think a good space to start is just, who are you? What's your background? How did you get to Rocketbook? I think we'll focus mostly on Rocketbook, but you know, what was the education and life experiences that got you to that point? And then why did you start that company? And then I guess shortly thereafter, there was a period before you met Jake. And so how did you get to that point where you met Jake, which my sense is that's when things really began.
Entrepreneurship is a young man's game, but I wasn't really listening. I graduated college with a computer science degree in 1999 and was always interested in starting my own company. But I just joined tech companies and of medium or large or small size and had a run through engineering roles and sales and business development roles. And it wasn't until I was like 36 when it just kind of occurred to me like, man, if you just keep on this path, you're never really going to start a company. And I just started to try really hard to think of ideas in a way that with renewed urgency. And I had three young kids at the time. And I just figured, you know, if I wait till they're older kids, I'm not going to be able to justify it to my wife at the time. I came up with a few ideas, but one of them was the precursor to Rocketbook, which I, you know, later sold for $50 million to Bic. But the first idea was a whiteboard related idea that I called Rocket Board. And when I was an engineer, when I was a salesperson in technology, I was using whiteboards a lot by myself, writing to-do lists in Teams, you know, brainstorming, even with customers when I was in sales, selling, you know, $1 million software packages for Salesforce.com to business customers. Whiteboards came up a lot. I remember waking up like in the middle of an airplane flight and being like, whiteboards, we could definitely do something with whiteboards. And so I had a few ideas, but what I landed on was there should be an app, I'm going to call it Rocket Board, that you take out your device, start up the app, you sit it down, you point it at a whiteboard that a person is using with just plain old Expo markers, and it sees the whiteboard, it cuts it out, colors are popped, white is white, the person who's in the way half of the time is removed, and then anyone can at least follow along with that whiteboard using just a link, right? So it's just one direction, very simple. I can be on a phone call with you and say, hey, follow along to this link. I'm writing something on a whiteboard and you're just following along. And that was my first idea. And I was employed at the time at Salesforce.com. And I just started playing with it and seeing if I could build anything like that.
I would use whiteboards all the time in my first job out of college. And you would just take a picture of the whiteboard. So the meeting would end. Everyone would be like, all right, they'd whip their camera out and they'd take a picture of the whiteboard. That was the status quo. So that was like the problem you were solving.
It was a problem I was solving, but I felt that taking a picture of the whiteboard wasn't enough for a lot of situations. If I'm whiteboarding and I'm talking and somebody's on the phone and they can't follow along, I want them to be able to follow along. So it was more of a live experience. One of the first things I did was I created a really cheap and shitty video that made it look like it worked, a demo video. And that was good enough for me to like show developers what I was trying to make. And then I started working on it myself, but also hiring people off of Elance at the time. And I would just like break down the problem and have them solve little parts of it. And then I would hire somebody. They wouldn't be able to do it. I would fire them. I had to hire and fire a bunch of people until I finally found someone in Portugal who I could collaborate with. And he was really smart, and he was just starting his consulting agency at the time. And we just got started working on it. I also was looking to improve the video, and I wanted to like redo it and make it properly, maybe to put on Kickstarter or something like that.
Why Kickstarter? Or was that just a foregone conclusion?
Kickstarter was definitely having a moment. I was obsessed with it. I just love the idea of being able to bring money in the door based off of pre-sales that other people would give you and in promise of a product that you would deliver later. I just thought the model was magical. I couldn't believe that ordinary people would pull out their credit card and pay whatever for a product that doesn't yet exist with the promise that they would get it later. But it seemed to be working. So I would just be on Kickstarter, just watching and observing and being envious of people who develop products. I saw one product that was a software product that raised $30,000. And I thought that was amazing, right? I put the video up there. My copy was probably pretty mediocre. It was like our first launch. It didn't reach its goal and it failed. But there were some backers who were very vocal about wanting to see this exist in the world. So it was enough to make me want to continue working on it.
What was the goal and what did you do?
The goal was somewhere around $50,000 or $70,000. I think we did somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000 of contributions. And probably 5,000 of that was my own credit card that I pulled out to make it look like there was some volume on there to start, which you always want to do on a Kickstarter. I didn't necessarily think that launching it on Kickstarter was the best idea, but it was very much a why not type of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so with a little bit of like encouragement, also through that campaign, there was a consulting firm who got in touch with me and said, we want to give you $5,000. And we just want like a license for our company to use this thing.
They had just seen it on Kickstarter?
Yeah, they just like sent me $5,000. And I said, yes, I promise to give you a license for your consulting company, right? So I kept going with that. Kickstarter failed. I started to sort of get it to work in reality. And then one day I put it up on Product Hunt, which people may know is a place where people discover products. And it was early days in Product Hunt too. And I also made a little hack where the landing page for Rocket Board showed the video, showed the first 10 seconds of the video. So you could kind of see what was going on, but then you could press play to see the whole video. But throughout that whole experience, it was just a box for your email address. And if you put it in there, it said, great, got it. You're on the waiting list. And if you wanted to cut to the head of the waiting list, share this link with 5 other people. So it was a little like hacky, growth hacky type of gimmicky thing that I put in there. And some people didn't like that I did that, but whatever, it worked. And when it went up on Product Hunt, that was just enough for this thing to start to feel like it was exploding. I was getting, you know, hundreds of email addresses a day, sometimes maybe 1,000 a day while I was, you know, developing this product. And I was like, wow, if I could convert, you know, 10% of these people, I'll have a real going concern, right? I'll have, if I could do $10 a month, you know, et cetera, like I've got $1 million business on my hands. Then I'd started actually putting the app in users' hands. Keep in mind, I'm doing the phone is doing picture taking, image enhancement, and a form of streaming. So when somebody could get this thing up and running, and if it worked well, the device would instantly become super hot and run out of batteries very fast. So, I mean, I was just churning users 100%. Meanwhile, I have this video, people like it, they like the idea of the app, but I'm running out of money. And I had saved up maybe a couple hundred grand from my job before. I was spending on myself, you know, our living. I've got 3 kids, I'm spending a little bit on some developers, and I'm running out of money really fast. And I had to just put everything down. And I woke up again from like a nap or something, and I was like, wait, a notebook. I can just make a scanning app for a notebook using all the technology I've already built. It'll be simpler than a real-time scanning thing for a whiteboard. But I'll sell a notebook. And then I had to just think to myself, well, how am I going to justify a sale of a notebook? What's special about this? So that's where I came up with the idea of a 7-symbol system on the bottom page of the notebook so that I would mark a symbol like the rocket or the diamond. And based on that, when I scanned it in, it would instantly send that page to a specific destination. So I'm imagining a student writes in there, it's the end of math class. They mark the diamond, they scan it in. That note instantly goes to their math subfolder inside of Google Docs for them without them having to press share, find Dropbox, find the document, find the folder, find the subfolder. So it would like save time, right? It would take the friction out of keeping your notes organized. That's what the value prop to the user was. But that the value prop to me was that now I had a justification for printing special pages and selling somebody a proprietary notebook that goes with this app. So now I had a physical product that I could sell someone. That was the magic that made this thing possible.
And also that kind of took it from B2B to B2C, right? Like with the first iteration was more B2B.
B2B or B2C, it totally changed. What I think you're hitting on is the distribution of this thing. So one thing that really made the difference for this company was designing a product with distribution in mind, meaning it's really hard to be successful if the app store is your primary distribution mode, right? So I've got this idea for a paper notebook that has a scanning app to scan and save your notes for you, right? So naturally, Like, while you're saving your pages on your phone and in the cloud, you could reuse the pages over and over. So I was thinking maybe these should be wipeable pages. And that was like my first idea, what I was going to launch, like a whiteboard style book with an app, right? And I thought that that kind of made it both real world, analog, digital, but now you could use this thing over and over. And back then I was listening a lot to This Week in Startups, and Jason Calacanis is a big name these days, but he was running the Launch Festival and he had said on Twitter, startups, please message me if you're a stealth startup. I'm looking for someone to launch on our Launch Festival. So I was like, hey, this is still pretty stealth. I just spent the weekend putting together a little demo video for Jason, showing this little book. And he instantly, after he looked at the video, just messaged me back. He's like, can you get out to San Francisco in 2 weeks? And I was like, yeah, I can do that. I had another co-founder at the time who was short-lived. And I called him up and I was like, hey, I want to go out to San Francisco. Do you want to go with me? And he had not yet quit his job. This was a side project for him that he was trying to help me out with and become my co-founder on. And he's like, he was just like, no, like, I don't believe in the book part. So I was like, all right, I'm on my own. I'll just go do it myself. I get there for rehearsals a couple weeks earlier. And Jason just tells me, no, you cannot launch this on stage by yourself. You need somebody to be doing the demonstration while you're talking. It's the way it works. It's going to be a bad presentation. So then I just had to like call up friends and ask somebody to like go out there and do it with me and be on stage. And I got to Jake, who, you know, as everyone knows now, is now my co-founder. And we went out there and we just like every day woke up and worked on our onstage presentation. We worked on the product and making it, you know, a little bit real, and worked on a video for Rocket Book while I was rehearsing for this and showing Jason and his friends a demo sort of in practice for this. They said, hey, what's up with the product roadmap? Like, where are you going? Okay, you got an app, you'll sell a bunch of books, but what's going to happen after that? I said, okay, well, reusability of notebooks is interesting. I have one design where you can take the notebook, put it in the microwave for about a minute, and it'll all erase, and then you'll be able to reuse it over and over. And Jason just said, stop. That is literally the only good thing you've ever said. Right. If you don't announce that as your product, there's no way you're going to be on my stage. You're kicked off. And so I'm like, okay, I went back to the Airbnb where Jake was, where we were staying. And I told him this. He's like, yeah, I bet we could do this. He was using We already, even though he wasn't officially my co-founder, but we're like kind of in it. And he's like, let's do it. Let's launch it. It's right. It's true. It's a great gimmick. It sounds awesome. We'll just give ourselves like 6 months to figure it out. On crowdfunding, we'll announce the date of delivery is 6 months, and that'll give us plenty of time to figure this out. And so we launch this on stage. We announce it. The crowd loves our sticky presentation. We were really funny during this presentation as well, which ended up being part of our brand. And at the end, I said to everybody in the crowd, there were a couple hundred people, I said, who here wants a Rocket Book? And, you know, some people raise their hand. I'm like, great. It's available now on Indiegogo. That day, I think we did like maybe $900 worth of pre-sales on Indiegogo. The next day, we did maybe a couple thousand. And the next day, about the same. And then Saturday, we were still in San Francisco. And what's cool is Indiegogo sends you a little notification, ding, when you get a backer. And we woke up Saturday and our phones were like, bing, 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 bing. It was out of control. I thought my phone was broken, but Jake's was doing the same thing. And we got $99,000 of pre-sales in one day because Indiegogo put us in their newsletter and we just converted like crazy because the idea of a microwave to erase notebook captivated people. And everyone was at least like, I got to try this. I've got to see this, right? So we ended up doing well over $1 million worth of pre-sales on Indiegogo.
That had nothing to do with the Launch Fest. That was just Indiegogo loved the idea and they put it in their newsletter.
Yeah, and probably what happened was we had enough traction from the Launch Festival where Indiegogo looked at the data and said, oh, this little project is doing kind of good. Let's put it in our newsletter, right? So one little thing turned into a snowball. Now, from there, we were psyched, right? We've got almost $1 million in the bank. We're feeling really good about ourselves.
Because this is such a different experience than when I ran a Kickstarter. So, I mean, we did ultimately get into a newsletter, and it was awesome. It was huge. It was towards the end of our Kickstarter. But it was a dogfight to get all those dollars leading up to that. And so basically, I mean, obviously the awesome thing about this is it's free, right? You didn't pay to acquire any of those customers.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
You probably viewed crowdfunding in this initial stage quite differently than I did, which, you know, I knew this is not going to spin off enough net profit for me to where I can then finance my business based on this. I'm using this to prove out some semblance of product market fit, get investors excited, and then raise some money on the back half of this and get some early customers. But I was not like going to fund the business based on this. Whereas you, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're like, damn, we can do the inventory run and then start financing the business on it off of internal cash flows based off these crowdfunding campaigns from day one, which is unique. Is that accurate?
It's almost accurate. What my initial mindset was, keep in mind, was I'm going to launch this Rocket Book thing. It's going to raise a few hundred K, maybe 300K. It's going to be easy to make. And I'm going to take the profits of that and I'm going to reinvest it into Rocket Board, because that is the software product that I had still believed in. But clearly, after this took off, I was like, I guess Rocket Book is the product. I can't really deny it. And in fact, after the success, we came home from San Francisco with almost $400,000 of pledges so far. And, you know, over the course of the next 9 months or so, it did generate over $1 million of sales, pre-sales, that was just money in the bank. And we thought we were just in a great position, right? We've got, you know, even if it takes about half that money to develop the books, maybe we've got about $500,000 left over. Things are looking great. Now, as it turns out, we didn't know how much trouble we were in. The software took a lot more time to develop and actually make good, right, on two platforms, Android and an iPhone. So that took, you know, six figures of investment. But also we kept working on making this microwave to erase notebook. And I'll try to quickly say how it works. We used these pens by Pilot, which turn clear at 140 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's included with this book. So all you have to do is warm this book to about 140 degrees Fahrenheit and all of the ink will turn clear. So you can use it over and over.
Does it turn clear or does it like evaporate? Is there still, you know, the ink on the page and it just changes color, or does it?
It still it turns clear. So, I mean, that's an Achilles heel that you're talking about as well, is it wasn't infinitely reusable because you're leaving a little film of pretty clear, almost clear stuff, right? And it would just kind of build up. And after you used it maybe 10 or 20 times, you'd be like, you know what? I either need a new one or something different, right? This whole microwave to erase notebook was not infinitely reusable. But that wasn't the big problem. The big problem was that when I made a prototype of a notebook, it would work great in my microwave. It would erase, let's say, around 1 minute. If I gave it to you to put in your microwave, in about a minute, it might not fully erase. And if I gave it to someone else to put in their microwave, in about a minute, it might burst into flames or char, because every microwave is so different, right? So we were trying really literally every formulation of paper, cover material, size, et cetera, and all of these different microwaves.
All of this is happening after people have already pre-bought.
That's right. And our video just shows it working, right? And we put some risks in there, but we didn't even really know what trouble we were getting ourselves into.
Throughout this process, were you ever like, this might not work?
Oh, yeah. And I'm running out of money and running out of options and slowly coming to the realization that I don't think I can ship a product here. And I'm like running out of money. Even if I did have the idea for the product, So long story short, through some ingenuity, I give Jake a lot of credit for this, definitely too. We came up with something that basically worked, but it was janky. Two things were important. One was, not only would you put this book in the microwave, you had to put a little mug of water on top of it as well. And what that did is, if the microwave was a very powerful one, it slowed everything down so the book wouldn't catch on fire with a hot spot, right? And then we wouldn't tell you, hey, put it in for 1 minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes. Instead, there was a little logo that we had with thermochromic ink. So when that logo turned clear, you'd have to put your face right up against the microwave and look at this logo and maybe be exposed to radiation, who knows? And then when that turns clear, cool, flip it over, do it again for the other side of the logo, and then ding, you're done. You know, it wasn't the most elegant product in the world. And then if you did all of that, the ink wouldn't magically disappear and you wouldn't have a perfect book.
Here's another thing that just like hit my brain as you were talking about all this. There is also always the alternative of just a regular notebook with those symbols at the bottom, your companion app. And, you know, you get through the notebook and you throw it out and you buy another Rocketbook notebook and you keep going. And it's like all of the functionality minus that microwave ability is still there. And arguably much of the value is still there. And you avoid all of this. Like, did that ever possibility ever enter your brain?
You're very logical about this, right? And it should have been version one of the book, right? It's the simpler version. Put that out there.
If Jason Calacanis hadn't freaking said gotten so excited.
If he hadn't gotten so excited, if he hadn't like prompted us to do this, we would have done it differently. But we also might not have succeeded doing that, because sales would have been tepid, man. Like, nobody wants to write about a book. Press do not want to write about a
book. Yeah, there's no wow factor.
But the microwave to erase notebook. Like, when we emailed reporters about this, reporters who were like, we're done covering Kickstarter, we don't cover Kickstarter, they're like, all right, we'll make an exception for this. This is zany enough, right? So just having a gimmick right out of the gate got us customers, email addresses, et cetera, that really helped to propel us into having some momentum.
Yeah, it also changes the product to the app versus the product being the notebook.
That's right.
You're really focusing on the notebook. You disrupted the notebook, which is like, no one's ever disrupted the notebook.
There were other notebooks out there with a companion app, right? Like Evernote partnered with Moleskine to make a paper book that had an app that worked. And so it was especially unnovel to just have an app working with a book. But when you introduce the reusability with microwave to erase, that just was like, it just blew the socks off of the press. And people covered this crowdfunding campaign quite a bit. And we got a lot of like Uncrate and Business Insider and all of this. And it just took off, right? But then it also put our backs against the wall to deliver a safe and workable product that was really, really hard. So we got that design to work, finally. And then we were like really running out of money. I needed another like $300,000 or $400,000 to like finish printing all of the books after we did like half of them. And we just didn't have it, right? Because we had spent a lot of this profits already. So on the unit economics, things were fine, right? It was somewhere around 40%, 50% gross margin, but we had spent a lot of this money on like just, you know, product development firms, et cetera. Meanwhile, we're super late. We've announced delay after delay after delay. And we're telling people that we're shipping books, but if you didn't get yours, all you know is like, maybe this is a scam, right? So people are writing in the comments that I'm a scammer, things that are kind of like death threats to me as well. And I'm like feeling like literally suicidal, right? And sometimes just to help myself sleep at night, I would go to other crowdfunding campaigns on Kickstarter and look how miserable they were doing. And I would console myself that I wasn't the only one.
Yeah, because there were many scams. I mean, this is one of the reasons why Kickstarter became less of a viable launch platform over a long period of time. There were so many scams. But the other thing too is like literally everyone delivers late. Everyone.
Yeah.
Myself included. We were, I want to say, 4 or 5 months late. And we got some angry people. The angriest people are the people who like they your project was the first thing they backed and they don't get it.
Like, did they ask for their money back?
Similar to the stuff you're talking about, but like more tepid, you know. I don't think anyone threatened my life over a box of protein bars, but no, they were not happy.
Yeah, it was just really painful just dealing with people who were very upset with me. But we had about $400K to figure out, or right around there, to figure out how to like get the money. So I, the one rule I broke is that, all right, we launched on Indiegogo. I was like, maybe we relaunch this on Kickstarter, but that's not allowed. Kickstarter is very clear. You can only launch novel products that have never been launched before on our platform, or at least new projects, right? So here's my kind of clever workaround. I put it up on Kickstarter, launched it, but I said that what we were financing was not another run of the books per se, but rather a Slack integration, a Trello integration, and like a Dropbox integration. So it was a whole new project that we were launching. It just so happens that the rewards were the same. A Rocketbook Wave, a microwave to erase notebook that works with our app. And when we relaunched, we launched on Kickstarter and we raised just enough to get out of bankruptcy and to be able to deliver those products that were sold on Kickstarter and to deliver the products that we were behind on from Indiegogo. And just by the skin of our teeth, we were viable and not bankrupt, and we delivered to everybody. And there were still huge delivery delays because fulfillment problems and things like that. But we were no longer, you know, fucked. We were alive. But we still, our main product was still the microwave to erase notebook. And when we put that up on Amazon and such, every once in a while, we would get like a 1-star review because, you know, people maybe didn't follow the instructions, or even if they did, it didn't work out so great. And sometimes people would burn their notebooks. And it was not easy having a product that was sort of unreliable out there and kind of scary, right? And we got invited to Shark Tank, where we showed off this notebook. And we're dressed up in orange astronaut outfits and showing a notebook that goes in the microwave. And the sharks just, they never took us seriously. They didn't even drill into our valuation. We're asking for a $4 million valuation. And they just made fun of us the whole time, basically. The only person who didn't make fun of us the whole time was Mark Cuban. He asked a series of logical questions that got to our user data and revealed a good reason to be out of the deal. And he exited that way. And I very much respect how he got to his no. Everyone else was just plain mean, right? But we were laughed off of the show with no deal in hand. And we came home and I was actually working on like relaunching Rocket Board at the time, but we put the brakes on that and said, we need to relaunch Rocket Book, but in a new embodiment. And while that whole thing had been going on with figuring out the microwave to erase notebook, we had tried all these types of synthetic pages too. And we found that with the same ink, they could wipe off perfectly with a little bit of water. It would stay on there nicely. It wouldn't wipe off with your hand, but a little bit of water, it would all come off of a plastic page very nicely. So after we had come back from Shark Tank, we had like 9 months between the filming and having it go live. And in that time, I was like, we need to launch another product to just show our friends, to show other people that we're just a machine. We're innovating. Even though the sharks laughed at us, we're continuing to be successful. So we launched what we called at the time Everlast, the Rocketbook Everlast. It was a synthetic page that you could write on with the same type of pen, a little bit of water, and it would all come off. And Will, it came off perfectly, right? There wasn't this problem with a film. There wasn't a problem with a microwave, right? Of it bursting to flames in the microwave. But I was not anticipating it being that much of a success because it didn't have the gimmickry of a microwave to erase notebook. So we put it up on Kickstarter. It was a new project, definitely a new project, a new product, called it the Rocketbook Everlast. And to my surprise, it knocked the socks off of our last crowdfunding campaign. It ended up doing well over $2 million in crowdfunding contributions in about 60 days.
Why do you think that? What, like, was, were there a lot of your backers of your prior notebook, or what do you attribute to that success?
We had tens of thousands of email addresses to work with, right? And we had a product that was still novel and still people wanted to try. And so what we did was we launched it on Kickstarter, and we didn't email all of our backers all at once. We emailed, let's say, 1,000 of them, enough to get high in the Kickstarter rankings and to make the project get high. And then when it started to fall in the popularity section, we would email another 1,000 backers and see it bump up. So we called it riding the wave, like surfing the wave. And we wanted to kind of keep it in the popularity rankings as high as possible, so that other people who were not our backers would discover us on Kickstarter and see, wow, this is a super popular product. And it would give us instant credibility. And then we got backers off of the Kickstarter platform that we didn't previously have, right? We also worked with Jellup, who did some crowdfunding advertising, and they specialize in sending traffic to Kickstarter and converting them. And they just had really great conversions with us toward the end of the campaign. And that gave us another few $100,000. And that was huge. And then after that, we delivered the product pretty promptly, got it up on Amazon, and the fact that it delivered on our promises, it became our main product. And now it's not called the Rocketbook Everlast. It's called the Rocketbook Core. It is 95-ish% of our sales. And just the company just started taking off. And this is before Shark Tank even aired. Then when Shark Tank later aired, it barely registered on our sales. Like we did maybe an extra $5,000 in sales that weekend. It wasn't monumental because of Shark Tank. But we had already started growing really fast because our next product that we just launched right before, that I did because I came home with a chip on our shoulder after Shark Tank, that prompted me to launch this product quickly. And it ended up like launching our company in a new direction. And I could sleep well at night because people weren't burning their notebooks in the microwave with our main product anymore. I had a great product that was getting great reviews on Amazon. And finally, the app was working really well. And we're really starting to like take off.
You mentioned the chip on your shoulder thing, which I think every entrepreneur has to some degree. But I know we've also talked about, you know, a lot of what drives you is tough experiences throughout your life. Like, what do you attribute to your intrinsic motivation to keep going throughout? Because, I mean, you had a pretty gnarly early stage of your company.
Yeah, I would imagine that most people might not have endured what was needed to be endured to bring this product from its idea into the market and into reality. And I think part of it was what I experienced was, you know, I had a weird idea, a bunch of weird ideas. And, you know, when I was working on them, plenty of people, you know, my neighbors, my friends were like, what are you working on? This is dumb. And how, you think this is going to be successful? You quit your job, a high paying lucrative job to work on this? Like, what are you thinking? You know, and I got a lot of negative social feedback from that. But I think, you know, my childhood was filled with not fitting in. Like I was bad at regular sports. Anything to do with a ball, I was the worst at, right? Which really sucks as a boy to just be really bad at sports. But then like I showed a little bit of promise at roller skating. Right. And so my dad started having me like go take lessons and compete in roller skating. I became a competitive figure skater. It was pretty good. Like I was like went to nationals at a younger age. And imagine being in middle school and high school, being bad at sports. In my case, like hitting puberty late. So it's kind of small. And then being a male figure skater. Like my everyday existence among my peers in school just fucking stuck, right? I did not fit in. Very few people wanted to hang out with me or be my friend. And I didn't even have time for friends either because I was training fucking figure skating all the time. I didn't have like a major career in figure skating, but I was able to parlay it into good essays that got me into a good college. I went to Cornell. And I got into Cornell when people ranked above me in the same high school didn't. Not because of my academics, but because I had this great story about skating. So it was just like, it was formative in me, because I think what it showed me is, all right, there are all these playing fields out there where great competitors are filling this arena and battling each other. And maybe you can't compete there. Go find another arena that is weird, nobody's paying attention to, and go do something original over there. And then that you can kind of cleverly turn that into something that turns into success for you, right? And I think that happened in my entrepreneurial journey, where when I came up with a zany, weird idea, I was able to stick with it and even deal with the social ostracism of people telling me it was a dumb idea, because I'd felt that before. It almost felt familiar to me.
If you start out and you're like, I want to do something, start a company, you're not necessarily going to say, I want to be in this category. The category kind of finds you through this meandering path.
Yeah, I think you're right. The category does find you in the following way, at least in my experience. First, I was sort of enamored with technology and computer vision and things like that. And I just put my brain into a mode of thinking about how it could apply to some problems out there, sort of. And then you just go into a mode of what feels like you have your eyes closed and you're groping around in the dark, right? And you're just kind of feeling around. And you're like, wait, that feels like that could be a thing. And then I would like develop a product or a video, and that would get me a little bit of a momentum, but it wasn't quite working. And then I had to pivot a little bit, what ended up moving away from just a pure app category over to stationary, just because I was continuing to grope around in the dark for ideas that could work for what I was sort of working on. And then it like clicked, and I wasn't thinking about whether this was a good industry to be in. And in fact, it was a bad industry to be in. You know, when I looked at the market, I was like, it looks like there's only $1 or $2 billion worth of paper notebooks being sold in the market. So like, what's up with that, right? Why am I going into that?
But to counter that, I love Blue Ocean Strategy as a book. And it seemed like this could be kind of a Blue Ocean thing where you're actually pulling people into the notebook category. Is that true, or is that not true?
I think that's somewhat true. I think you are pulling people into the notebook category, or at least reinvigorating their excitement about it.
Yeah.
Somebody who was previously paying $1.20 for a Mead notebook is now interested in paying $30 for a notebook that is reusable, has some digital stuff going on with it, but more from a personality aspect, is the embodiment of a tech forward version of a reinvention of a notebook, right? So I was able to maybe 10x or more the willingness for a consumer to purchase this product because of its function, but also what it stood for, right? Taking a dusty category and bringing it into the new world with reinvention of digital and physical ways. I also did see Post-it out there. And they were a multi-billion dollar company, and their big innovation was an adhesive. And I was thinking to myself, if I could innovate in two major ways, digital and physical, then maybe I could be big as well. I never drove it to become a billion dollar company. But, you know, $50 million acquisition for us was hugely life-changing for me, Jake, and a couple of our employees and, you know, our whole team as well.
What was in your mind when you started? I imagine it was largely survival, but then once you hit your first product success, you're like, oh, I could grow this and I could exit this. Were there some number that was in your mind?
I had a 15-year career or so before I realized I really hate working for large or small companies. And I'm like, I considered myself unemployable and I needed to start my own thing. It just took me a long time to figure that out. And so when I started Rocketbook or Rocket Board or whatever you want to call it at the time, I had like one goal in mind. One was to stay independent and also to be able to make a living and also to be working on a product that I was just kind of like liked waking up in the morning to work on. I was so like done with working in a traditional way that just changing my career and having freedom was my big priority. And I was leaving a job. I mean, I left a job where I left about 300K worth of stock on the table that if I had just stuck around for a little while, I would have like had that in my pocket. And I was making, you know, not quite 500K a year, but almost that, you know? So I was like making good money.
Damn. That's a big opportunity cost.
Yeah, it was a real, and especially at the time, right? I didn't know that I was leaving for something lucrative or what would become lucrative. And I was leaving for a better lifestyle, basically. And I wanted to invent something. Finally, I just wanted to like, I always had the idea that I wanted to be someone who invented something. Now, I don't think that except for most things, like maybe if you had a small agency or something like that, I think once you're in the world of something that can scale, it's almost impossible to turn it into a lifestyle company. It's just, once you get this momentum and growth starts happening, it starts sucking up cash. So you have to continue to sell and be very profitable on an accrual basis. You have to continue to grow. And the opportunity becomes evident to you that if you don't grow and chase this opportunity, somebody else is going to see this and steal your opportunity. And once you start making $10,000 a month and you see it growing, you get kind of excited about it turning into $50,000 a month. And then once you get there, you get kind of excited about it turning into $105,000. And so your appetites just increase when you get fed, right? You don't actually satisfy your appetites with success.
You also get more confident. Your ego starts to inflate and you're like, damn, I'm pretty good. Now I want to be great.
You get bolder, never mind bold about where we could go. It wasn't until after we were, you know, regularly doing millions of dollars in sales where I was like, oh, you know what? I see the opportunity here. I see that we could be the digital and sustainable option in every stationary space, right? We've got legal pads, we've got notebooks, we've got post-its, you name it. Now we can turn that into a $1 billion vision. And I started to truly get excited about that. I also noticed something that was unique about our business, which was, you know, unlike if you buy this random pen from Walmart, Pilot does not get your email address, right? But whether you buy a rocket book off of our Shopify site or off of the shelf of Walmart, when you sign up for our app, we have your email address. So we were able to develop a business that was direct to consumer in all of our communications and relationships, even if we had a wholesale distribution model through Walmart, Target, et cetera. And we were able to build up a several million person email list and have the largest, very active email list, way larger than all of the other big pen and stationery companies combined. And we became like this direct-to-consumer asset. We were highly profitable. We showed potential of being a disruptor. And therefore, we didn't have a lot of potential acquirers, but one strategic one, BIC, really saw the value of what we could become and you know, saw upside in acquiring us and downside if they didn't acquire us.
You mentioned you had this huge email list. When I first met you, and you told me about that, your ability to just ping another 1,000 people and ride the wave in a crowdfunding respect, but also you launched so many new things. You always had a reason to email people, and then they had a reason to give you money. And it was just like the community is kind of bandied about as a term excessively, I would say, but you actually did have a community of people who were super engaged, really liked the products. I was always super jealous of that because that's not really possible in many spaces. Like, you know what, you can't really build a community around a protein bar, let's say. But how else did you leverage community, and to what extent did word of mouth and having a high virality coefficient of people referring your products to other people, like how, to what extent did that fuel the business?
Yeah, people really like a notebook. They carry it around. and then reinventing it and doing something novel with it set up the situation for good word of mouth. And press wanted to cover it, at least when it was fairly new. And so word of mouth was the one marketing channel that we were ever able to get to work. So you may be jealous of me, but I might also be jealous of brands like you. I've probably spent a lot more on IQ bars in the past 6 months than most people do on notebooks during a lifetime, just because the consumption of an edible product, I'd think I'm a multi-$1,000 customer to you. Whereas we don't have a lot of those in somebody who buys one reusable notebook or a few of them. So we were never able to get Facebook ads to work in a way where we were able to like see them be profitable, except for just retargeting, but that's just fish in a barrel. We never got any scalable marketing effort to work. The only thing that we were able to measure was growing our business was word of mouth. So like with that, what do? You just keep throwing money at other marketing initiatives, things like that? Yeah, you might. But one thing that worked for us, at least for some amount of time, was, all right, let's build a little content engine, podcasts, live events, TikTok, things like this. The strategy was not to use that content engine to go acquire new customers who hadn't heard of us, because that just wouldn't have paid off. But instead, target all that content to our existing customers so that, let's say, you know, John was normally going to introduce Rocketbook to three of his friends. If he then maybe sees a TikTok and an Instagram post and gets a great email and here's our podcast, maybe those three friends could turn into six friends. So that's why we developed a content engine. We focused it that way. And hard to measure with any definitive, but it really did seem to drive continued growth for quite a while anyway.
How did it work when you went into brick and mortar? I think it was Target and maybe others. Did it just not work? Did it kind of work, but you had all these issues because you needed a display to really educate the consumer?
If we put Rocketbook on a shelf by itself, even with the best packaging in the world, and we put that on the shelf at Staples or Target, it would do kind of poorly. Not so much where they literally kicked us out, but they weren't like, the category manager was not like paying much attention to us. But when Staples put in a display of a digital writing category with us and competitors who are competing with us in some digital writing stuff, then Rocketbook would be the number one selling thing in there and it would sell 10x. So just being in a category, highlighting and having that category evangelized, and then letting the customer be convinced that they need to buy something within this category, which will it be, helped Rocketbook tremendously, right?
That's super interesting because that has implications for competition, right? Usually people think competition's bad. They're cannibalizing my customers. And I've experienced the opposite of that. But I didn't know how to like mentally frame it. You actually framed it in a really interesting way, which is like for the consumer, it legitimized the category. Yep. That there were 2, 3, 4 players.
If you go to the paper notebook aisle in Walmart and you stand there for 5 hours, you're going to see like one person buy something. Whereas if you go in the protein bar aisle in Walmart and stand there for 5 hours, I think you're going to see a lot of people picking up a lot of protein bars, right? So the category itself wasn't awesome, but we did fairly well when they took our product and actually put it in like a gadgets area, right? And they positioned this as not just a paper notebook, but that's where the foot traffic was too. And that's where people are just buying more tech forward things. So our notebook would not necessarily draw people into the paper notebook aisle, like, but if you put us in the right place, we could hold our own.
That's kind of the blue ocean strategy piece. It dovetails with that, which is someone who didn't go to Walmart or Target or whatever to buy a notebook. They went to check out gadgets. They walk over there, they check stuff up, they find you, they buy you. They were not there to buy a notebook. They just like the concept. Whereas, you know, for the notebook aisle, someone went in there to get a notebook. They need a notebook. you're pulling people into the category who were not there to get a notebook versus I'm there to get a notebook. It's so fundamentally different, the buyer side psychology. Did you go into brick and mortar because, oh, we need to be omnichannel to make the asset more valuable? Or you're just like, hey, we could be leaving a lot of money on the table by not, or we hit a ceiling on digital and we need, that's the next leg up. Like, how did that, all those things factor in?
Yeah, well, we definitely didn't do it in terms of like, oh, we need to be in omnichannel to increase our multiple or be interesting to these acquirers. We didn't put that much thought into it. It was really simply like, we're not in these stores. We should be because it will drive sales. Also, we started to believe that if we did a good job of being in stores, it would be like another billboard for Rocketbook, where we started to think this way. Right. I ultimately don't think it had that strong effect on the trajectory of our company, because inside of a store, there's only so much you can display on packaging. Whereas on a web page with a video and animated GIFs, you can really make a product like ours come alive.
Were you vendor central? Were you wholesaling to them and they were then retailing?
We were wholesaling to them from the beginning, because they had a program where they invited people into, it was like an Amazon startup thing. And they were inviting people off of crowdfunding into that. And they made you sell direct to them as opposed to, you know, sell on your own and control your own price.
Okay. The exit. This is always like the juiciest thing. Why exit? Let's just start there. Like, why exit? You were running a pretty big, pretty profitable business.
We started off just kind of exploring optionality, meaning I wanted to know if this thing was sellable, right? I was not determined to sell it. So I got my corporate lawyer was also kind of a really experienced M&A lawyer. And he introduced us to some investment bankers who work in middle market, you know, smaller, you know, things of this size. They put together a list of companies, everyone from Google, right? Google could have bought it, had some digital elements, to, you know, stationary players, et cetera. So we went all over the place. We got a few offers. We had somebody else in the stationary space who was interested in buying us. We had a private equity sort of private office wanting to buy about 49% of the company so that Jake and I would take some money off the table, but then we would then grow it to be ultimately much larger, et cetera, et cetera. But when Vic came along, they gave us at least in the beginning, was an awesome offer that looked like it might be all cash. We ended up having to restructure it after COVID, et cetera, where we had earnouts. But we ultimately decided to sell it for a few reasons. One was like pure burnout. We got creative at so many points in this business to like get to the next level of growth, make this thing successful, not die at this stage, that it just, from the beginning to the end, it just felt like we were always in a form of panic mode. There was adventurousness to it. The experience was awesome. And I look back on it like type 2 fun, but it was also like our adrenal glands, me and Jake both were in agreement that our adrenal glands were kind of shot. And the idea of taking this rocket ship and parking it at a space station successfully for us and for our employees and for the brand sounded like a gigantic relief to us. Even if it could become a $1 billion brand under our watch, just having it not burn in flames was like, felt really, really good. And so, you know, we took the offer. At first had a great offer, but then they wanted to restructure it once COVID hit. We had a bunch of renegotiation and finally were able to come up with something that was really, I think, good for all involved. We had a 2.25 year earnout period where Jake and I had to stay on to and achieve certain goals to hit our earnouts and we're on board. I think that earnout period was too long for everybody involved.
Yeah, that's pretty long. Yeah.
We thought it was a good idea at the beginning. We both thought that the founders were super important because the company was so complex with a digital app infrastructure and with some physical innovations, et cetera, that Jake and I would be really instrumental for 2 years. But I think we were both parties were incorrect about that. We were instrumental for 1 year, if you ask me. But I mean, we were just excited to really be able to declare success and to be able to sell this in a way that, you know, is very, very meaningful financially for both me and Jake and for our early employees as well.
And you just want the win at some point. You want that validation. I'm actually like impressed by people who could sell and don't.
Depends on your phase in life. I think, you know, I still have kids who are in the house and are, you know, 11, 14, 15, et cetera. If I waited another 5 years or 10 years or something like that to have a financial windfall, I would not be able to share that with them at all. It would be like after they left the house, right? And so it's not just like how much money you make, it's how much you can like experience the time with some amount of money. And literally just like, even if I could have made 5X 5 or 10 years later, I don't know if it really would have had that as much impact on my life. Whereas, you know, this age where I'm like between 45 and 50, I'm still pretty young. I'm still able to have a lot of fun with some money and get a boat and live on the water and do these fun things. Whereas like, you know, how many more years or decades do I really have left to enjoy and deploy wealth in a fun lifestyle to have fun with kids and be able to do whatever the F I want and work or not work, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, there starts to be a giant opportunity cost of time. Like time becomes so much more valuable. But now I'm curious because often people say something like what you just said, book the win and get right back into it. And so they like contradict themselves, which you haven't done.
No.
But I could see you doing it because you just have built up so much muscle memory of, oh, I need to be solving a problem. And often, too, you want to solve a bigger problem the second time around, an even more ambitious problem, because you need that. You need to fight that habituation and get that new, bigger stimulus. So, okay, you're out, right? You exited. Just like walk me through the psychology of all of that. Did you have this gaping hole in your life?
Having a windfall and establishing like the level of wealth that, you know, is kind of frees you up a lot of ways can also be like very disruptive in a way. About a year after the deal was done, we were beginning a divorce proceeding, right? And very amicable today. They say like money tears people apart, or like money problems tear people apart. But I think actually, if you have a marriage that isn't working, but also isn't horribly bad, I think being middle class can keep you in that marriage. Because imagine you're middle class, you got a house, and you're doing okay. But if you were to get divorced, you go from middle class to basically poor.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, we split things up and she deserves every penny because she supported me during the darkest days. But then getting that windfall just loosened things up and allowed us to take that step. So there was some disruption there.
So it's like disruptive, but it's like relieving too.
Yeah.
In a way.
And I mean, everyone's divorce story is different, but whenever anyone said like, oh, I'm so sorry, I was like, no, the proper words are congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
But I mean, during that, now I'm a single dad 50% of the time. It's weird. Like I'm both, you know, hyper busy and overwhelmed by trying to keep up with being a parent mostly on my own. We still co-parent and we help each other, et cetera. So we're not like totally on our own. You know, I also had to make up for some lost time. So my kids, you know, 11 and 14, 15, there were times during early Rocketbook where I just like was barely present or ruining vacations because I had to work in a surprise way that like ruined everything when they were all, you know, at the Cape or at a pond or something like that. And so I just decided when I did exit BIC, I made it a rule that I was not allowed to think about my next startup or network or anything for at least like 6 months, and just like try to be a super dad during the summer, connect as deeply as I could with my kids. And I'm still very much like in that mode. So being able to take a step back from ambitions of world domination or business or invention and just be a dad is something that, you know, maybe I put off for way too long, but now I'm able to at least attempt to make up for lost time. And it seems to be really enriching my life and their and the kids' lives too. I'm pretty psyched about it.
So you're not sweating it. Like you're not like, I have to do something tomorrow.
The stance I had where like, oh, I'm going to do nothing with business for a while. It's been a while now. So now I'm starting to pressure myself and to think, okay, what should I be doing? So it started, the pressure is self-imposed, but it's starting to like creep back. And I am starting to think about expectations and get a bit uneasy because I don't want to be retired. I have developed certain, you know, muscles and skills. I'm a sort of turned into this type of warrior. I need to go out and find a war to fight. I don't want to become soft.
Yeah. You can't just turn that switch off at all. Should we finish up with some rapid fire? The standard rapid fire?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay. Starting with the classic Peter Thiel question. What important truth do you, do very few people agree with you on? What super contrarian thing do you know to be true that everyone else thinks is not true?
If you're going to achieve something unusual, like inventing something or bringing something to market, like which was my goal, I think you have to realize that there's a million other people who have the same day-to-day as you. Why are you going to have some idea and bring it out? And so you've got to expect your brain to become different in some way. So doing exercises or even frankly, taking certain psychedelic drugs and combining all different types of things are really essential to put you into different states of mind. So I'm constantly trying to think of just different ways to get my brain in a different state.
And is that an ongoing thing? Right, because you're talking about it with regard to idea generation. But once you get the idea, oh, I'm going to build, I took psychedelics, I thought of this cool thing, I'm going to build that thing.
It might be more episodic. And in my case with Rocketbook, I mean, we did need a constant stream of ideas and product and marketing tactics and things like that. So ideation and having wacky and weird ideas was instrumental throughout my tenure in Rocketbook. I do believe that. But of course, having the initial idea for a product that could become product market fit was the most important thing. And you probably need that creativity a lot more. I think as your company more matures, then dealing with culture and team and ERP systems and HR processes and things like that take a little bit less creativity. But now I'm back to it, right? Now I need to think of an idea. So I need to play with breath work. You know, I think walking on uneven surfaces, like when you're hiking is really instrumental, or walking. I think just sitting down and forcing yourself to come up with 10 ideas a day, which may be very crappy ideas, is changes your brain. I think the way you write a post every day changes your, like, I bet that has been like completely has changed your brain because you're masterful at it now. But I bet when you first started doing it, you kind of were awkward about it or it was tricky, right? But now I'm imagining that exercise has like made you more creative, made you more insightful, not just been expression for you, but actually has changed your brain. So I'm thinking about things like that, but I'm curious, has that changed your brain?
Yeah, it's an off ramp for ideas. So I think generally good to have an off ramp for ideas. You think of ideas in your head. And the cool thing about LinkedIn, but I think the same could be said for a journal or whatever, any way of, you know, you could audio record, give yourself an off-ramp for ideas.
Yeah.
And I think what's cool about social media too is it's a bi-directional situation. So you can unload that thought and then you can get feedback on it really, really, really quick, yeah. Like within minutes. Hey, that's a dumb thought. Oh, that's a brilliant thought. Oh, I agree, but actually I would tweak this. Like it's an immediate feedback machine, which you don't get just journaling. And I think there's like pros and cons, right? Social media is toxic in many ways, and you get trolls and you get annoying people and you get people you disagree with or don't respect or whatever. But then some set you really do respect and you're like, whoa, that was an interesting way of thinking about the thought I had. And so it self-perpetuates. But once you have an off-ramp, for whatever reason, you generate more things to offload onto that off-ramp. I don't know why. I mean, it's just like pattern recognition, I guess.
I think your brain has confidence that if you come up with an idea, it's going to go somewhere. So your brain actually then decides to put the brain calories to work to generating the ideas.
You get a reward for good ideas, and therefore you're incentivized to think of good ideas.
Yes, I like that.
And the reward's so silly, right? It's like likes and comments, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't, like, it's still a reward.
Yep.
The dopamine still hits. You still feel euphoric. So does it matter that it's silly? No, I don't think so. Okay, cool. So commonly cited platitudes about what it takes for a startup to win that you think are wrong.
I've mostly heard investors talk this way, and that is that they want to invest in a startup founder who's like perfectly morally virtuous and maybe an angel. Like, they talk about integrity, integrity, integrity. And I get what they're saying, but I also want to work with other founders, whether I'm investing in or working with them, who have the ability to maintain integrity so that they can have a strong bond with their teammates. People trust them and they deserve that trust. Yet, when they need to, they can be a fucking killer, right? And they can slit a throat. Because I need somebody that, like, there's been times in Rocketbook history and others where you need somebody who can play dirty because survival is at stake from time to time.
Yeah. All right, cool. What was your single biggest regret or mistake that you made along the way? What would you do differently?
I think I regret this. And that is, I just had like a good, even before I started up, but like a good 10, 15 year run where I just did Adderall during the day and then drank at the night, right? So I just definitely sacrificed my health way too much and gave into the stress and came up with an unhealthy pattern, whether it was a coping mechanism or whatever. But I would like to go back in time and see what would have happened if I lived cleaner, took more walks, didn't take Adderall in the morning and didn't drink. And now I'm like free of that habit. And I'm like so grateful I'm no longer there.
How did you define success pre-startup? And then how do you define it today?
Pre-startup, I really just saw success as being able to work on what I dreamt of is being able to work on something creative day in and day out. And I wasn't actually, I had some dreams of making money, but only so that I would have the breathing room to be able to work on creative stuff, not have to sit down and do email and work on a boring to-do list, but be able to, you know, think of an idea and work on it. And to this day, I kind of still think that way. I mean, I also now have a bigger appreciation now that my kids are older for how important it is to be a big presence in their life. Now that like time is running out. So that's a huge part of what I consider success. I feel like I'm now achieving that level of success in my parenting that I wasn't achieving before. But I think, you know, being able to express yourself and realize that you are just a part of the universe attempting to express itself and then figuring out a way to fulfill that role. I'm not that religious or anything, but that's like a form of spirituality that I subscribe to. So being able to be creative and having the ability to do that and then expressing creativity, I think is a success to me.
Boom. I think that's a good spot to end it.
Yeah.
Went a little over, but we always do.
Great.
Thanks for sharing all that. And
that was fun.
All right, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. And thank you to our sponsors, IQ Bar. Go to Amazon.com. Search for IQ Bar, buy one, wait for it to arrive, leave a review. Please leave a review. Reviews are massive. Our second sponsor is Ramp. Go to ramp.com/glass. They give you $250 for free when you sign up. It's the best credit card / spend management software there is. Use it for years. Love it. Our third sponsor is Gorgias, GORGIAS.com. It's the best help desk software there is. We use it too. Also love it. Request a demo and mention Eating Glass. They will give you preferential treatment. They'll treat you well. If you like the podcast in general, subscribe, review it, tell a couple friends, tell your mom, and tune in a couple weeks. Talk to you then.